You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul Bloom.
Hola, Bob Wright.
¿Cómo estás?
Muy bien.
Yo también. ¿Y dónde estás?
Oh, no.
You didn't think I could rise to the challenge, did you? Like,
no.
You're on one of your exotic vacations in wherever, in some resort in Mexico, and you thought, you know, I'll say hola or whatever you said, and Bob won't even know what to say.
Hola was all I got. Hola, gracias, muy bien.
I got that impression, and I decided I shouldn't embarrass you any further. So let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're Paul Bloom, publisher of the famous, infamous in some rabbinical circles, we won't go into that, newsletter Small Potatoes. Is it rabbinical or rabbinic? It's rabbinical.
I would say rabbinical.
Okay. But we won't go into that. Maybe in overtime.
Bob is alluding to a rabbi who also has a small potato.
Also, want to go into a little more detail, Paul? Who had it first?
Yeah, it's possible she has had it first.
Possible she's preparing a lawsuit even as we speak, and I'm ready.
There's nothing new under the sun.
Nope. You mean rabbis are always filing lawsuits or what?
Rabbis, there's so little. No, I'm not going to go there, but
trying to get you into as much trouble as I can. Yeah. But listen, Paul. Let's just cut straight to the news. You recall what the naysayers said, right?
Go on.
Nay. They said nay. That's why they call them naysayers. But more specifically, Paul, they said that Donald Trump was not the kind of politician who could bring a divided nation together. Do you remember when they said that?
They did.
Boy,
say that.
Boy, were they wrong.
They
and
did
you
say
as
that.
A Canadian are in the perfect, although, of course, you don't spend any time in Canada since you're one of the coastal cosmopolitan elites who are rightly resented by true Canadians. You still, nonetheless, you know enough about Canada to be in position to elaborate, right?
This is true. Trump has brought Canadians together in anger against Trump. I was just reading a poll earlier because I do research for our discussions. Mm-hmm. 80% of Canadians would not become American citizens. Now, the numbers change a little bit when you ask Canadians aged 18 to 24, and you sweeten the pot, you say they get American currency and American taxes. Then I forget the number. Numbers is a bit higher because they're just ungrateful young people. But the rest of us are furious. The rest of us would stay in Canada. Would refuse Trump's offer, and about 50% believe Trump is not being serious when he promises to make us a 51st state. Mm-hmm. I think it's like it's the term bullshit was coined by Harry Frankfurt. Is it Frankfurt or Frankfurter?
I wouldn't say coined the term.
No,
the definitive treatise, the definitive good. Academic treatment of bullshit, is from a Princeton philosopher named, as you said, proceed.
Harry Frankfurt. Mm-hmm. And he in this delightful little book, he used a term to refer to something that's not a lie. Very careful to say it's not a lie, because a liar cares about the truth. A liar knows what's true and then conveys something to get you to believe that something that is false is true. A bullshitter has no regard for the truth, just says stuff. And Trump is the consummate bullshitter. So I'm not even sure there's a fact of the matter as to whether or not Trump really cares about Canada becoming a 51st state, or is just saying this to amuse himself or to get votes or to shock people or to terrorize people. Trump himself doesn't even know. Oh, nor does he
care. Saying it.
He keeps saying it. He has not dropped it. I have thought it's sort of, you know, it's like it's gentle teasing. Like, you know, like it used to be like little Marco. And, you know, Sleepy Jeb, and we're 51st state Canada. But maybe it's more than that.
Yeah, it's such a puzzle. Let me give you some documentary evidence of how it has brought Canadians together. So what's the name of this Trumpist politician who will probably be the next prime minister? Some Trumpist as Canadians go, I mean.
Pierre Poilievre.
Okay. So since you're not in Canada, you probably haven't seen this little video he put out, but I'm going to try to summon the manual dexterity and the sophisticated technology, as you can see, to show this thing that he put out. So he's Trump's like ally in Canada. Yes. Okay, just listen closely to what he says. He doesn't mention Trump's name, but come on.
Hi, everyone. With the threat of tariffs and other insults, Canadians are uniting like never before around our pride and love in our great country. And what better way to do it than raising the flag? This Saturday is, in fact, Flag Day.
Paul, you probably didn't know this Saturday is Flag Day, but I digress.
I did not know it was Flag Day. I really did not know. I didn't even know we had a Flag Day.
You have a Flag Day.
Apparently
and
we
Pierre
do.
Is taking advantage of it. You know, if I were is there a single like liberal candidate who's going to oppose him in the general? Is it whatever you call your elections in Canada?
It's between it's between two candidates. I think there's a favorite whose name I'm blanking out on, Mark somebody, who has been involved in the Canadian bank and everything.
If I was one of them, I would say Pierre is afraid to denounce Trump by name. He will be Trump's lapdog if he becomes our prime minister. I'm denouncing Trump by name. He's a bad guy. That's what they should do. Put the pressure on this guy.
It does sound to you like it's something that's polite, Bob. That's a very American thing you're suggesting. But you know,
Canada's becoming more like America.
We don't get in the dirt like that.
We're just
that.
One step ahead of you. Face it. We're drawing you down the spiral toward ruin.
Look, you're not wrong. So the conservatives and Polly is by far a favorite. Trudeau is deeply unpopular, has agreed to step down. There'll be an election within the Liberal Party, a decision process within the Liberal Party to choose his successor. The successor is, no matter who it is going to get stuck with all of Trudeau's policies and reputation. And unless something happens, the conservative guy, Poilievre, is going to win. You know, but you're right that this stuff puts him in a little bit of a bind because he's the conservative guy. I think he wants to play up his connection with Trump, his good relationships with Trump, get Trump's support. But at the same time, us Canadians have had a bellyful of Trump. And so
there you go.
So
that's the way
to
talk. You
a
can run for
I'm
office. I've had a belly full of that man, and I'll denounce him by name. Pierre would be his lap poodle.
Yeah.
No, you don't want to go ethnic. You don't want to in Canada, you don't want to start like sound like a francophobe, right? You don't want to illusion would be going too far. Just
laugh. You can be my political advisor. Like I say, little French poodle, and you say, no, you talk me down.
No, just call it a lapdog. Keep the nation united.
Yes, this will be an issue in Canadian politics, how to deal with Trump. But look, I'm sure we talked about this a couple weeks ago. There's a point in which this is funny, and there's a point in which it's really not fucking funny, which is that if Trump hits us with these
I'm
tariffs.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at something that's not funny. Go ahead.
Well, if Trump hits us at these tariffs, yes, it will cause some harm to certain American industries that rely on Canadian products and everything, and you will get this mild hit. But the U.S. is by far our number one trading partner. And like, I don't know what, like 30% of our GDP is tied up in this. It could move our country into a depression. It could really mess us up economically very seriously.
Yeah. No, there are.
Not funny now.
There are some people in Gaza who agree with you that Trump's not being sufficiently considerate of human beings in other places. But you know, the thing, to get back to this Pierre guy, the thing about Trump's, I thought this was like a real, you know, so typical of his psychology. A few weeks ago, some reporter said, it was shortly after the 51st state thing began, she said, you know, this guy, Pierre, whatever, who many people think will win this election and become Canada's leader. He's a conservative, but even he said Canada's not going to become the 51st state, something like that. And Trump just snapped, well, maybe he won't win the election. And it's like, Donald, this is your ally. This is the best it's going to get in Canada in terms of a leader who is on your wavelength, willing to do your bidding. It's you know, as you know, I can continue to puzzle over what exactly is going on in Trump's head and in Elon's head, for that matter. But one element is just sheer adolescent reactiveness. And it's weird. It's so weird. I just have no idea it's going to get this weird, honestly.
It is
in so many ways. Weird. I mean, I'm alluding to all kinds of things going on the domestic and foreign front when I say
it is
that.
Very weird. And there is a vibe shift of a sort, which I find kind of awful. The most recent thing I heard, and I assume this is real news, is that Google Calendar no longer shows Black History Month or Pride Times or whatever. They've just taken it off.
Also, Google Maps has relabeled the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. If you're in America, if you're in Mexico, you'll see the Gulf of Mexico. Now, that is the way they handle things like the Persian Gulf versus the whatever the Arabs want to call it. It's like location specific, but still, that is pretty abject submission. I mean, because it's not part of America, and so I would think you just go by convention, and polls have already shown that most Americans oppose renaming it.
Yeah. Every industry, every corporation, every news outlet is desperately sucking up to Trump. Businesses that he has legal problems with are settling with him because they're just terrified. He's a vindictive authoritarian ruler who has shown a positive delight in destroying people destroying companies because he can, and he does it, if you don't bend a knee. So that's America you are now living.
Everybody is bending the knee, just about. Sam Altman, Elon Musk. Elon's going beyond bending the knee.
I gotta ask you an Elon Musk question, which was prompted by there's somebody who's a correspondent, and we've been corresponding for a long time, and she sends me this actually very, very thoughtful arguments against me. And at one point I was defending Musk a long time ago and his long termism. And then she sent me an email recently reminding me of all the terrible things he'd been doing recently. And I guess what I was trying to wonder. Here's what I was wondering. I understood Musk when he says we want to be an interplanetary species. And there's some people who claim, I was listening to Kara Swisher, and she said, that's kind of what Musk wants. This is a serious desire, what he has. But what does he want now? Like cutting American foreign aid to people who really need it, destroying the NIH, trying to destroy research universities, the education department. Is it simply pleasing Trump? Like, what does he want?
I mean, it's puzzling. And before, I actually have a new theory, but before I get to it, I want to just add one more dimension to the puzzle. His like complete disregard for truth. It's like Trump is one thing, right? Trump's not that smart a guy. And I kind of, the sense of which I understand his disregard for truth, he's just gotten positive reinforcement his whole life for saying the most extreme thing. And like, that's his whole game almost in negotiating. He just says, no, I won't take less than, whatever ridiculous thing. And that's how he starts. And I guess it's wound up working often enough. But Musk is a smart guy. And yet, he's just always going off half-cocked. I mean, there was this great moment in the Oval Office just yesterday on video. You know, he had made a big deal about how the U.S., he's discovered that the U.S. is spending X million dollars on condoms for Gaza. Did you see this? And this reporter said to him, unfortunately, English wasn't her native language, so it wasn't as good a moment as it could have been when the big reveal came. But she said, we've looked into this, and there's a place called Gaza in Mozambique. These condoms are going to Mozambique where there is an AIDS problem. They're not going to Gaza, the Gaza you said they were going to. And he's like, well, I'm not going to bat 1,000. I mean, I'm going to get some things wrong. Well, wait, you're this incredibly powerful person. On Twitter, when you retweet something, it goes to jillions of people. And he does this all the time, retweets the most implausable shit, those notices you at least used to get. I've gotten them pretty recently on
the community
Twitter.
Notes, community notes.
No, the thing where you press retweet and it says, you're retweeting something that links to something. It says, do you want to read this before retweeting? Yeah. You know, they should like tattoo that on the back of Musk's right hand. I mean, he does this all the time. And it's okay. You want my theory now? My new theory of Musk?
I'll take your theory.
He once said that the chances that we're living in a simulation, he didn't put it quite this way, but they're like 99.99%. He said something like, the odds that we're not living in a simulation are 1 billion to 1 or something. Like, he's sure we're living in a simulation. And I sometimes think he's just like, man, this is a fucking video game. You know, these people aren't real. You know, I have consciousness. I don't know. Do they? Maybe. But it's all like a game. That's one theory. What do you think of that one?
It could be. Walter Isaacson said he once saw him play poker. Elon Musk play poker. And every hand, Elon Musk doesn't really know how to play poker. Every hand, he goes all in. Buys himself more money when he runs out. Just goes all in. And sometimes he ends up winning. And there's this idea of extreme risk taking. And if you think of it as a video game, it's fun.
See, this is the great danger to the world, what you're highlighting here, is that it's like the world is full of aspiring business people and entrepreneurs who take risks. You know, they're not all risk averse. They go for the big one. Most of them fall by the wayside. And the people who succeed are the ones who just, they get it right time and time again. And sometimes that reflects some skill. Yeah. And sometimes it reflects some skill and some luck. And sometimes mainly luck, whatever. But you wind up with the business, with our like alpha business people being all these crazy fucking risk takers, and it's worked out for them so far, but they keep pushing it, and now they're all advising us on AI policy, you know. Plus they have a lot of other incentives to actually give us bad guidance there, and all of that kind of came to a fruition in this Paris AI conference this week, which was supposed to be about safety and wound up being about how we spend more money to speed things up. I don't know.
The simulation discussion, by the way, is reminding me, we talk about books we've read. I'm starting to read your friend, everyone's your friend, Ross Doudat's, Doudat.
And I continue to insist that it's pronounced Douthat.
Douthat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I prefer Doudat.
I like Doudat because he's writing
great
on religion.
Brand. All
like,
kinds just, of puns.
He has this book out on religion. And I'm starting to I've heard him on a few podcasts. I am as atheist as you can imagine. But if anybody, it sounds like he has some interest, he puts together sort of interesting arguments and puts together. And some of it is sort of, I saw a little bit of similarity where early in a book he says, well, you know, we live in a world of incredible design. But Darwin's theory explains the design, but one can ask about the probability of the mechanism of natural selection coming out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. It made me think a little bit about you.
Well, he could actually strengthen that argument. He actually, you know, he was called on to interview me about my book, The Evolution of God, at a public event in New York, these many years ago. I would go further and say, maybe he did. Did he get into this argument that evolution itself, although yes, the immediate explanation is this mechanism of natural selection, that's what drives it. It does have this interesting tendency to create more complex and intelligent beings, and it's carried life through higher and higher levels of organization, you know, multi-celled societies of multi-celled, and now humans through cultural evolution are carrying the, you know, social organization at a global level. Did he get to say that? Because see, that I think that's, yeah.
I'm only on page 11, and I'm not sure he goes that way, but it's just, it's a way of retaining the argument from design and making it compatible.
I should ask him if he wants to come on my podcast.
You guys would
my
have
humble
a
little podcast,
I think.
Yes.
But
we would. So
and by the way, at the end of he was talking with this is going to find this immensely frustrating. He's talking with Jeffrey Goldberg, the podcast I listened to him, and at the end,
another friend of mine,
he mentions you.
I'm joking, but go ahead.
Your book, Evolution of God. No, flatteringly, and have a little conversation about it.
Wait.
I forget Ross, all of you.
Wait. Ross, who had the conversation? I lapsed. Go ahead. Who had the conversation?
Ross and Goldberg had a little conversation.
Ross brought up my name in Goldberg's presence?
Or Goldberg brought up.
No, I don't think. He didn't bring up my name. No, he didn't.
Anyway, it was a perfectly good conversation. I'm going to frustrate you by saying I totally forget what they said. So now you can say, okay, let's cut this conversation and go back.
I'm going to go check this out.
Yeah, but you should talk to Ross. Get the thing about his last name settled.
I'm pretty confident it's much closer to doubt it than to doubt it.
So the worry is, suppose I find his book persuasive, and he is persuasive to listen to. I've heard he's the best person I've ever heard making the case for religion. So once I find his book persuasive, could you imagine? Not only would I become religious, but he says in this final chapter, he's going to sort of seal the deal and say, you shouldn't just become religious, you become Christian. And suppose I find
Does he say that?
That's what he says. He says
Christianity is the one true. I mean, you're supposed to say that. It's true. That is, if you're Christian.
He's going to make a case for religion in general. He says, look, better to be Hindu or Jewish or whatever, or Muslim, than to be an atheist.
Than to be Paul Bloom. But
if you really want to spike it, go for Christianity and maybe Catholicism, actually. But I'm trying to think, this is an interesting epistemic problem, which is if I'm persuaded of this, it is going to cause a serious rift in all of my relationships. Maybe you'd still talk to me, but my friends.
Your friend Sam Harris would definitely stage an intervention.
Sam Harris.
Flying to whatever exotic place you happen to be in at the time on Sam's private jet.
I'd be in the Italian programmers Riviera, and on board. My friends are coming to see me. I said, "Oh, how nice!" And then all of a sudden, and my wife would not be happy. If I was religious, that would be okay. But if I was Christian, I might have God's problem, my family.
I would embrace you.
You'd be the last one. So maybe I shouldn't read the book.
No, go ahead. Live dangerously.
I want to believe true things. And if it turns out that, you know, the divinity of Christ and died for our sins is all true, I'd like to know it. But man.
Trust yourself. Trust the strength of your intellect, Paul. You'll come out
on
whatever
person.
The right side of this is. I believe you'll be there.
Okay.
Did you watch the Super Bowl? Because in keeping with an increasingly kind of predictable tradition, everyone interviewed credited God with their victory. This drives my wife so crazy. Because the idea is God wanted our team to win and didn't want the other team to win. Whereas one could argue even that part of the message of Christianity is that God loves all of us equally. But
all teams should win?
That all teams should win. God is about, God blurbed my book, Non-Zero, you know. God is all about win-win games. So the coach said that. Now the quarterback, Jalen Hurts, just said God is good. Yeah, that was relatively low key as as these things went. But did you see any of the Super Bowl ads?
I did not, but you sent me a couple
I did.
To look at, which I did. There was one for Gemini I thought was incredibly sweet.
This is the Google AI.
Yeah.
I just thought the contrast between that and the OpenAI ad was kind of interesting. But yeah, the Gemini ad was about something that I've just learned that actually a lot of people do, which is they use the AI to prepare them for job interviews. It's apparently good.
Yeah, that was one of the first ads. I forget, it was for ChatGPT or something, was a... It might have been for ChatGPT. It might have been for, I think it was for ChatGPT, where someone's staring at their phone and they say, so how do I look? And then this playful female voice says, oh, you should comb your hair, you know, But you look great. You sound great. Yeah.
Oh, well, that was a, yeah, I think I know what you mean. That wasn't actually, an ad, that was a
demo.
That was somebody at OpenAI when they unveiled some product and they were doing one of these live demo things. Yeah. The, the Gemini thing was so clever. So first of all, the OpenAI ad was like, it seemed like kind of out of Steve Jobs' playbook. Like, this is like, we are big, we are visionary, we are cutting edge. It was like this kind of, I guess you could say digitally pointillistic yeah. animation that depicted the great breakthroughs in technology, the spear, agriculture, the wheel, the steam engine, blah, blah, blah. And then there's AI and the narrator says all progress has a starting point. And then you see the ChatGPT logo and some lady says, or on the screen, it says all progress has a starting point. And then some lady says, what do you want to create next to the ChatGPT? And it was like establishing, it was establishing ChatGPT as the, it's like the Kleenex. It's like,
yeah,
you know, we are the brand. We are the brand that stands for the whole category. And this is huge and you shouldn't be afraid of it. It's all going to be great. But the Google ad was taking pains to connect it to our humanity and in that way, like, not make us feel threat. I mean, you remember this, but you responded warmly to the Google ad.
I did. I'm a sucker for that kind of thing. And it was about, I think, a father and his daughter. And he's describing all of his attributes and describing basically his work in raising his child. Mm-hmm. Patience, perseverance, teamwork, motivation, energy, and everything. It was absolutely adorable.
Yeah. So it may
have come off as a little bit too woke. So I'm sure the Trump administration will now be shutting down the company.
Wait. Do you mean because the voice that he had selected, the Gemini voice he selected, seemed to be the voice of a black person?
Yeah, that in part, yes, that was immediately noticeable. And also, he's a father and he's raising a child, and it seemed. And one gets the impression that in fact that was his primary occupation. I think, in many ways, the Trump administration will send people to speak to him about this, speak to the company about this.
Yeah, by the way, careful what you say about that voice. In the O.J. Simpson trial, which some of us are old enough to remember, somebody testified who was near the scene of the crime that he heard somebody yelling and it sounded like a black guy.
Yeah.
And they challenged him. Simpson's defense attorneys made that sound like a racist thing to say. And so he took it back. He withdrew the testimony, as I recall. But that did seem to be the case here. Yeah, it starts out. At the beginning, he's just saying, okay, Gemini, help me prepare for my job interview. He's clearly a father. He's in the kitchen doing the shit you got to do because he's got kids. And then at some point, it kind of asks him to describe what he does now or something. And all the other questions he answers, like his answers are about what he does as a husband and father.
Yeah,
and they have these heartwarming scenes, and they genuinely were. Even I thought some of them were.
Even you, like, there's a scene where he says, "Yes, and I deal with conflict, and I commit my mistakes." And then you see him; he has a fight with his daughter. You see him slipping a note under her door saying, "I'm sorry." Really.
Is the scene with the sick dog where the girl's starting to cry.
Oh yeah,
I'm a dog guy, but. But then at the end, you know, and he says things like, I got used to working long hours with a small team, you know, meaning his family. Yeah. And then at the very end, the thing says, last question, when it comes to work, what motivates you? And he says, I guess knowing people can depend on me. And I think the Gemini says, I think you're ready for this job interview. But it was.
Well, I'm going to choke up. This will be right? A first for our podcast. I'm going to choke up on it. There's really something.
Mickey did that once. Go ahead. There's a long tradition of this.
He choked up because
this is followed by my ridiculing them when they do this. But go ahead.
That Trump was going to win. Is that what kind of got to him?
No, Mickey. I won't go into detail. It was in the parrot room.
I am a sucker. I'm a sucker for ads. There was an ad that Apple has done some of the greatest ads and one of the worst ads. One really good ad was the idea of the Apple iPod, the iPods for the ears, being as used as a hearing aid. I don't know. You have to see this. There's a father and his children are playing. It's all muffled. And then he puts on these things and all of a sudden it becomes clear. And it's just these beautiful moments of his child saying, I love you and all that stuff. Oh, it's just great.
Then on the other hand,
that's one of the worst ads.
Where they smash everything you love before your eyes.
That's right. They had all this.
That was unbelievable. I personally look, Tim Cook seems like a nice guy, but I think he's a disaster
for
Apple.
It was the worst ad ever. It was.
This is one small thing.
Piano, violin, an old school typewriter. All of these beautiful instruments.
If anybody missed it, there's a big controversy over it a few months ago. It's like one of these big smashing machines. And what I didn't know is apparently this is like a genre of video on YouTube. Did you know that? That's what they were playing on. There's a whole genre. People go to YouTube to watch these giant smashing machines smash shit, apparently. But Apple put like, you know, guitar, like everything that
everything
is the old
love.
World that we're losing. Because of technology, because now AI can generate the music without guitars and without people. And it was just like our greatest fears realized before our eyes. And then Apple wants to identify with it. It was mind blowing.
Although in this defense, there's a recent one from Apple, which will join our couple of fascinations, which is a severance theme. So it's Tim Cook and the CEO, and he's going down an elevator. And then the elevator opens and his eyes kind of glaze over. Now he's become an innie and he's walking through the corridors. And
wait, you're saying there is an ad like this?
Yep.
A with actual Tim Apple. Cook?
Yes, actual Tim Cook.
It sounds like an improvement.
They're learning from their mistakes.
So speaking of severance, we were going to talk about that, but we talk about that in overtime generally.
So speaking of AI, Sam Altman offered Elon Musk offered Sam Altman, was it $89
billion?
$97 billion.
For OpenAI, I think what's really up there going on is, you know, Altman, in his last investment round, he promised the new investors that OpenAI would become a for-profit company by some date, or he would give them something, or they would get recompense somehow or something. And it's a very complicated thing to take something that is a subsidiary of a nonprofit and kind of spin it out, you know? And so some people think that Musk is laying down a marker because, of course, he has an AI company. He's a competitor of OpenAI. Plus, he hates Sam, who he thinks swindled him into donating to OpenAI early on.
An accusation which may have some merit.
Altman is, no one has ever denied that he's an operator. And I've even speculated as much. I've put kind of a twist on it in some piece I wrote for Non-Zero. But the idea is that Musk wants to, you know, ultimately the people who decide whether if the investors do like buy, I think this is how it work. In effect, they buy the company from the nonprofit. They reimburse the nonprofit, I guess, with some combination of cash and stock. I don't know. But the idea is that, you know, that'll be decided. Whether that's fair will be decided by, like, I guess, state attorney generals and so on. I don't know. But Musk is like
attorneys general.
Did I say attorney generals?
It's OK. I live to correct things like that.
That's a pretty cheap gotcha, Paul. I got to say, man,
it's I just have it in my back pocket.
That's, you know, you were waiting to pounce. You've been waiting for this moment for months, haven't you, Paul?
Sitting there. I have a little post-it on my thing. Yeah. Attorneys general. I didn't mean to derail you.
I've lost my train of thought completely. No, the idea is that Musk is trying to establish that the market value of this company is at least $97 billion, so that the company will have to surrender that much to the nonprofit.
Yeah.
But what I don't get is, like, I thought the idea was, and I run a nonprofit, I've run into an issue kind of like this, that if you are going to take all of the property and intellectual property that a non-zero, that a nonprofit owns, mine is called the Non-Zero Foundation, you have to give them the market value. And what's puzzling to me is that there's a sense in which Sam Altman himself has established that the market value is higher than $97 billion, because the implied valuation of the company during the last round of investment was something like $170 billion. Now he's gathering investment from this total sucker who, I mean, I'm sorry, nice guy, but runs SoftBank, the guy who did the White House photo op with Altman, who's going to just put a shitload of money in, apparently, at a $300 billion valuation. Which I think, you know, given the fact that I think this DeepSeek thing elevates already existing questions about whether building foundation models is going to wind up being a profitable business, I think it's a little high. But anyway, my point is, I would think, okay, well, then that's the value of your company. So you got to give the nonprofit $300 billion. Your own investors are saying that is the value of the company. Now, I guess, obviously, there's a distinction between market value established through investment. Investors are known, that's a complicated story. And market value established, you know, in the market by people actually making an offer. Yeah. So, but anyway, I think Musk is trying to set the floor at $97 billion, which I don't think they were planning on giving the nonprofit that much of cash and stock. That's what I think is going on.
So if Altman said, fine, deal, Elon Musk would say, I'm just kidding. I just wanted to get a price set here.
Well, he apparently gathered the investors who would be up for it. I mean, I don't think that would be a crazy purchase, actually, at $97 billion. OpenAI is currently leading the pack, and it may well be that AI becomes a platform and they run the dominant platform, and that's possible. But $300 billion, I personally am not going to give them $300 billion. I'm going to stick with this. I'm going to be firm about this. What?
If ChatGPT disappeared off the face of the earth, wouldn't people just move to DeepSeek and Grok and Claude and Gemini?
That's the thought. And the claim is that it can become a platform first, but, you know, the way like Windows became a platform for a while, you know, still is, you develop software for it. And because so many people have Windows, more people develop software. And because there's the software, more people want to have Windows. Same with these smartphone platforms. You have obvious network effects, positive network externalities, which means the more people are using it, the more valuable it is. It's not obvious to me that we have that with AI.
That's right. You know, not yet.
And in fact, a lot of these companies that offer kind of apps, so to speak, specialized things on top of them, they'll give, you can get them with any number of different LLMs underneath them. And they all work, you know, pretty well. So, should we go into overtime?
Yeah, let's go into overtime.
I want to say one more thing about the Super Bowl ads and AI. It's just like the contrast, the Gemini commercial was kind of saying, yes, AI is coming, but everything great about being human, your family, this, you know, it's not threatened. We're, if anything, going to, you know, add to the value of that by turning it into a talking point in your job interview or whatever. And whereas the OpenAI thing was more austere and like, yeah, we're headed into the future. This isn't for the faint of heart. Just different vibes.
So just one more thing on the Super Bowl. It is apparently true that for many years they had end racism at the you know, prominently stetched on the goal line.
I think
line.
On the end zone, appropriately enough, right?
Yes.
The end zone is where you end racism.
And then they took it away to put in choose love. Now, choose love. Let me just check. I cannot immediately find whether it's, but it was put there. They started using it in 2020 in the aftermath of the George Floyd murder. And then, and so I don't know how strong, I mean, Choose Love is also good or whatever. But the idea is they did it because they didn't want to offend Trump.
And well, he was at the game. It's funny. I had
that kind
seen
of, that kind of is a bit on the nose. I mean, regardless of Trump's, you become offended. He said, we're going to take away something and racism because you don't want to hurt your feelings.
And, well, that was actually, I think that was a compromise. So they had end racism. And then there were people who wanted to appease Trump. Then there were people who said, well, Trump's here, so let's do Choose Love. And then there was a faction that said, Trump's here, so let's do Choose Racism.
That would be something. Yes.
I think these things, you know, around George Floyd time, you started noticing that the players had on the back of their helmets these slogans, and they could choose. I think some said end racism, some said choose love. You could choose your slogan. And I think this is all, these have all along been two of them. I mean, end racism just, I'm sorry, it just kind of annoys me because, like, well, obviously, if we knew how to do that, we would. You can't just wish that into existence. Now, love, you can try to choose, not always easy, but that seems a little more, actionable.
I don't think these are meant as actionable instructions, either one of them. They're meant to sort of express certain vibes and certain express approval for certain values. And I don't know.
Yeah,
that's
true.
I don't want to be all woke and everything, but end racism sounds like a really nice, nice thing.
It's a great aspiration. It's just like,
and like, end hate.
Also, end it is, I'm sorry, that's a little unrealistic. We should reduce its frequency and its expression. People
reduce racism.
Stereotype about groups, and we should try to, you know, discourage the pernicious forms of that, and racism is one, but, you know. Anyway, I'm choosing love, Paul.
Reduce racism by
10%. That will end racism. Yeah.
One more thing, while we're on this,
this is like a Steve Jobs presentation. It's like at the end, oh, one more thing. This better be big if it's in the Steve Jobs tradition.
My reference here would be Columbo. Like, I'm one more thing.
I'm sure
our older viewers would just kind of love that. But Elon Musk and Trump may not be the free speech champions that everyone says they are. So their scrubbing of DEI sites and their scrubbing of forbidden words, where websites get removed if they have their forbidden words. Grants get defunded if they have their forbidden words. And the forbidden words are words like, in one list I've seen, words that include, you know, racism, stereotyping, in one case, confirmation bias is a forbidden term. In another case, the words women and female. The term Orwellian gets overused nonetheless.
No, I mean, that's what it gets back to. Like, the people doing this are the people who, like, don't check whether the condoms are going to Gaza, this Gaza or that Gaza. You know, it's like, it's beyond my wildest nightmares is what's unfolding. And it's like a lot of the policy, it's like, look, if Trump has the right to do these things, well, just do them in orderly fashion. You know, you've got control of the fucking Congress. They're all terrified of you. If you need legislation, you can probably get that. But Trump and Musk actively like freaking people out. They love the attention.
Flood the zone with shit. Whatever you call it. Chaos. Just terrify
chaos
people.
Agents.
Just chaos agents. It's just wonderful. We're like 1 month into his administration.
Yeah, it's got
it. It's fairly exhausting.
It can't keep up at this pace.
So let's move to that.
We should go into overtime. One thing we're going to talk about is Severance for sure, because we're going to find out who the king of Severance analysis is. And I'm not going to give it away right now, but.
So you
for
said
people
you
watching,
knew.
I'm pointing to the person and I'm not pointing to Paul. That's all I'm going to say. No more plot spoilers. Okay. No, we're not going to say like which particular prescient thing I said about Severance weeks ago just nailed the shit down. We're not going to talk about that. I mean, I'm not going to give it away. We will talk about it in overtime, that's for sure. Because Paul is going to be acknowledging somebody's greatness, I think, when we go into overtime. You think, Paul?
What's overtime is all about? Those of you who don't pay for overtime, just missing this regularly, where I just say, Bob, you're so smart.
It's all about Bob. Now, how can people get into overtime, Paul? They can subscribe to either the Non-Zero newsletter or the Small Potatoes newsletter, but doing that is so confusing because you might wind up giving money to a rabbi.
Under the Trump administration and Elon Musk particularly, giving money to a rabbi is a very suspect activity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So choose wisely, choose love, and choose Bob. Okay. So we're going in. Thanks, everybody.
Here we go.
We are headed into overtime.